This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. As soon as the war in the Gulf began, the Israeli government instituted a round-the-clock curfew in the occupied territories of the West Bank and Gaza Strip. This clampdown comes 3 years into the Intifada, the Palestinian uprising against the Israeli occupation. The Israeli government is afraid that without a curfew, Palestinians, many of whom have aligned themselves with Saddam Hussein, would escalate their rebellion and participate in acts of terrorism against Israelis. We'll hear a more complete explanation a little later from an Israeli Defense Force spokesperson. But first, to find out what life is like today in the occupied territories, we call Dr. Saeb Erekat. He's a political science professor at Amasya University. He serves on the boards of the Palestinian Human Rights Center in Jerusalem and the Palestinian Cultural Association. He's also a founding member of the Arab-Palestinian Writers Association. He spoke with me earlier today from his home in Jericho. I asked him to describe the restrictions he's now living under on the West Bank.
15 minutes after war started in the Gulf, and exactly at 2:30 in the morning of January 17th, we heard Israeli vehicles roaming our town here and the rest of the West Bank and Gaza, imposing curfews and telling us word by word that if you leave the doors of your home, you'll be shot at with real bullets. Today, it's been 14 days, and 1.7 million Palestinians in the West Bank and Gaza have been confined to their homes. The psychological impact of putting 1.7 million people, including women and children, under this house arrest for such a prolonged period has been also enormous. I'm a father of two twin daughters who are 8 years old. I have never seen my daughters act in the way they're acting now. They hardly talk to each other now. They fight, they scream. And because I'm scared for their lives, I don't want them to play in the backyard or in the front yard because I'm afraid that they'll be shot at. So this devastating impact on Palestinian life has been enormous. And the irony of it, that we are civilians at times of war and in accordance with the 4th Geneva Conventions. The world should say something, and to our surprise, we have not heard one comment, neither from the Secretary General of the UN, or from the Red Cross, or from the United States government, or the other Western government, which to us means that have the world stop seeing us even.
How many hours a day does the curfew apply to? Which hours are you free to leave the house?
We are not allowed to leave. It's a curfew that goes on for 24 hours continuously. Now, in the past 14 days, we were given two times to go and shop 2 hours each. But mind you that the sources of supply have been cut. I mean, farmers cannot go and harvest and get to the market. People cannot work, so they don't have the money to buy the stuff. In terms of doctors, even doctors don't have permissions to go around to see their patients. And I'm talking about a curfew that is imposed 24 hours a day, continuous for the last 14 days.
So you've only had two different periods of 2 hours to leave
yes.
the house? Do you have food in your house?
Yes, we have food in our home. I mean, I'm a professor, and my salary is good, and I can buy. But honestly, even that me as a professor, you know, I don't know if this curfew will continue with the whole duration of war. And the Americans and the British are saying that war may take months, I won't be able to buy food in the next 2 weeks because I can't get my salary.
How do you think that the curfew, the crackdown during this war, is going to affect relationships between Arabs and Jews within the peace movement?
Well, I think this war had changed so many things. We have seen that the peace movements in Israel, I've heard some reports yesterday, and I heard some of their spokesmen that I know very well have sent letters to peace movements in Europe asking them not to demonstrate against the war. And it was shocking for me to hear Peace Now or peace activists advocating the continuation of war and the continuation of devastation and telling the whole world that settlements of political disputes can only be done by war. And this is contrary to what we stood for. We stood for that a political solution can be reached in the Palestinian-Israeli conflict. And now the peace movements in Israel, I think they have failed their first test.
But they feel that they are under attack in a war that they didn't want to join. They didn't want to join this war, yet Saddam Hussein has made it very clear that he is considering using chemical weapons against Israel, and he's already used conventional weapons against
Israel. Well, we have been also, as Palestinians, under so much attack by the Israelis. We had 1,300 people killed in the past 3 years, 80,000 wounded. We had thousands in jails without trials even. But if we want to use to restore to our emotions and to abandon our sanity and advocate, armed struggle, that is an easy answer to do. This is why, peace is a commitment. Once you say that you stand for peace, once you stand for in the peace camp, you should know one thing, that peace is much more difficult than war. War is something so easy. It's easy to start. And those who think peace should know that the struggle is so difficult and so hard. And sanity should never be abandoned. And when I say that the Israeli peace movement had failed the first test, it showed that their commitment was so weak and so shaken by what's happening. I know that war is ugly. I know that this war may slide into a total disaster at the end if nobody can stop it. But nevertheless, once you put a commitment to peace, it means taking the hard choice.
We've been hearing about the enthusiasm expressed by Palestinians every time a Scud missile hits in Israel. From your perspective, living in the West Bank, is there that enthusiasm?
Yes, I heard it myself, but I talked to people about it, and the reaction I got, you should know that Palestinians have suffered more than enough. I mean, people tell me that, for the past 3 years, they have demolished 400 homes. In the past 3 years, they have not only demolished 400 Palestinian homes, but they also wounded 80,000 Palestinian youths and killed 1,300 Palestinians and uprooted 85,000 trees. They prevented our children from going to schools, and they continued to close universities for the past 3 years. And they say that maybe that this will awaken them, because I think this amount of suffering that the Israelis have inflicted on the Palestinians have prompted this reaction, this gut reaction. But people should know that 90% of all casualties of any war will always be civilians.
Can you explain the popularity of Saddam Hussein among Palestinians?
I think it's one simple explanation. If we go back to August 1st, one day before the outbreak of war, Palestinians were left alone, abandoned. Everybody turned their back on the Palestinians. Even Secretary of State James Baker, when he was mad at the Israelis, he told them, "You can call me at the White House when you're ready for peace." And yet, we were left alone under the mercy of a Shamir Sharon government with one objective in mind, to bring the West Bank and Gaza to a point of no return as far as settlements and demography are concerned. Should I remind you of the massacres committed in the past years against Palestinians? And then comes a voice, any voice, telling the Palestinians, "I will end your suffering, I will solve your problem." Saddam did that, where everybody else failed to do. So don't expect the Palestinians to turn their back on someone who offers them hope. Because if President Bush would come and say, "I will end Palestinian suffering and I will put an end to their occupation and I will work for their freedom," believe me, he'll be also having a lot of popularity among us.
But isn't
and I think one of the lessons that should be learned from this war is that maybe and only maybe the Palestinians should not be left without hope.
But isn't it clear that Saddam Hussein is a tyrant who's using the Palestinians in a very opportunistic way? I mean,
I think that's what I told you. When the whole world decided to leave the Palestinians and leave them in the cold and turn their back on them, and comes a voice who tells you, "I'm going to solve your problem." Okay, you will have to say, "Okay, I'm going to test that." And the point is at a time when Mandela was meeting with de Klerk in South Africa, at a time when Germany was being reunified, at a time when we as Palestinian moderates were speaking of a dialogue between us and the Israelis in Cairo, at a time when Secretary Baker was trying to start a peace process, comes a government of Israel, headed by Shamir, and said no to everything, and said the River Jordan to the Mediterranean are the boundaries of Israel, meaning that only by the sword shall this region live. I mean, this by itself created a vacuum, a political vacuum, because now Palestinian moderates were discredited by Shamir, the American administration was discredited by Shamir, President Mubarak was discredited by Shamir, and this vacuum was filled by Saddam. And it's so obvious that Now the Palestinians are being used by the Egyptians, by the Iraqis, by the Syrians, by the Saudis, by the Israelis. Everybody's raising now the Palestinian banner, which shows the extent and the necessity to start addressing the Palestinian question with the required elements.
Dr. Arakat, do you and your family have gas masks?
No.
How come?
Well, this is one of the ironies that when we hear sirens, when we hear sirens that missiles are hitting or somebody coming, you know, my daughters come to me and ask me, how come you didn't buy us gas masks? Try to answer this question for them. What shall I tell them? What shall I say? Shall I tell them that for four months, I tried, I approached the UN agencies, I approached the Red Cross, we approached everybody, all the consul generals here, foreigners and so on, telling them, we want to buy gas masks. And yet, we were denied this right by the Israelis.
I thought you were allowed to buy gas masks.
What?
I thought Palestinians weren't going to be given gas masks, but they would be allowed to buy gas masks.
We were not allowed to buy gas masks or given gas masks. There was a decision of the Israeli High Court one day before the war to distribute gas masks on the Palestinians who live in villages that are close to the Green Line, the 67 line. And the Israeli commander said, no, we don't have that many gas masks, and we will do our best. But believe me, I have a family here, a pregnant wife, two daughters, a son who's 3 years old, myself, my old father, we all without gas masks. And I would have bought them. Believe me, I would have bought them because I know that my children would have asked me this question, and they did, and they are asking this question.
Let me get back to something we were talking about before. You said that you felt that the Israeli peace movement was failing the test in the sense that with a war breaking out and violence being directed against them, they've lost that mission of peace and they're now in support of this war. But the Intifada, the Palestinian uprising, has also been a movement that uses violence in its opposition to the Israeli government.
Well, I don't know why you say that, because we have been having an Intifada urging people day after day, hour after hour, not to use guns. And guns were not used, maybe a few incidents in the past 3 years. Palestinians accepted to die alone for the past 3 years. Chairman Arafat was sending letters signed with his name here, urging Palestinians not to use guns. And the restraint shown up by the Palestinians in the Intifada is unprecedented. And I don't know how, you know, where do you get such information to say that violence? I mean, when somebody decides to confront Israel with the most advanced technology in the Middle East, with the most backward technology the humans had ever knew, the stone, it's a clear message from Palestinians. It's telling the Israelis and the world, kill me or free me. It's a cry for freedom. And Palestinians did not use guns, and we advocated and we continue to say, do not use guns. The whole world knows about this. In the Intifada, no guns were used. There were few, very, very, very few isolated incidents here and there.
One last question. Do you know when the next time will be that you'll be allowed out of the house?
I think so far they have, I think it's going to be in 3 days.
And how do they let you know?
They announce it in the microphone.
Dr. Arakat, I want to thank you very much for your time.
It's my pleasure, man. Thank you very much for the interview.
Dr. Saeb Arakat is a Palestinian professor living on the West Bank. Why does Israel feel a 24-hour curfew for the Palestinians in the occupied territories is necessary? We'll ask Moshe Fogel of the Israeli Defense Force after the short break. This is Fresh Air. After we spoke with Saeb Arakat about life on the West Bank under 24-hour curfew, we called Moshe Fogel in Jerusalem to find out the reasons for the curfew. He's press spokesperson for the Israeli Defense Force.
Since the start of the war, we've imposed a curfew, which has basically meant that people can go out shopping daily for supplies, and healthcare is taken care of, and ambulances operate, and clinics operate, as well as essential services such as bakeries and other supplies, but that persons have to be confined to the area where they live so that we are not faced with a threat of terrorism or violence aimed at supporting Saddam Hussein, as stated by the residents themselves, who said that if there would be a war, they would go out into the streets or go out and perpetrate terrorist attacks against Israel. So the main purpose and goal of the curfew has been to prevent that type of violence.
How is the curfew being enforced?
Basically, anyone who breaks the curfew can be fined or tried up to 3 months in prison. But 3 months is the maximum sentence, and this is only for someone who flagrantly violates the curfew.
Is there the threat of being shot if you violate the curfew?
By no means. In fact, through the entire period of time when there has been a curfew, I think there's been one or two cases in which there was some type of firing which occurred.
Since Palestinians can't leave their homes long enough to work, that means that there's no income coming in. What are Israeli concerns over Palestinians maintaining income and being able to buy food when they're allowed out of the house to shop?
We have a welfare officer, and we have all the welfare services which are designed to meet the needs of the Palestinians, so that we have no evidence whatsoever of anyone who can who is hungry or is in need and is not taken care of. There are a wide variety of organizations operating in the territories who provide voluntary assistance, and the civil administration is also very active in making sure that there's no one who goes hungry and there's no one who is in need that does not receive assistance.
What kind of allowances are being made for medical care under the curfew? Are doctors allowed to pay visits to patients, or are sick people allowed to go to clinics or hospitals?
Doctors have special permits which allow them to move freely during the curfew. All clinics operate normally, and the hospital and clinical staff receive special passes to be able to work in the hospitals, and all the services, including ambulance services, operate absolutely routinely and normally without any interference. Let me just add that the farmers are allowed to go and harvest their crops, and people are allowed to run their services and businesses if they are vital to the economy, such as bakeries and those types of services.
The question has been raised, how does a democracy like Israel justify depriving civilians of basic civil liberties?
We're talking about a belligerent occupation of a belligerent population. We're talking about people who affiliate themselves with the forces trying to attack us. So Arab Israelis, Muslim and Christian, are just like Israelis, free to move around. It has nothing to do with anyone's civil rights. But if there is one civil right that that people should have, it's the right to defend themselves. And I think that the people of Israel have that right to at least defend themselves against the potential of terrorist attack. And we saw that when dozens of Katyusha rockets were fired last night at Israel from Palestinian and PLO positions in Lebanon.
You're saying that Israel is enforcing this curfew to prevent violent uprising against Israel or sabotage of Israel. But is it unfair to enforce that upon people who aren't part of an organized movement and who aren't planning violent acts against Israel, because all Palestinians in the occupied territories are being affected equally by this?
We have very, very solid information, and it doesn't take any military expert to understand that a large population of over a million Palestinians who are belligerent and have expressed their design and their goal to see the end of the state of Israel, who affiliate themselves openly in mass demonstrations with Saddam Hussein, who cheer and express avid support for Saddam Hussein with every missile that falls in Tel Aviv, and who we know plan also subversive terrorist attacks within the state of Israel, then we think we have the right to defend ourselves. And in this case, we recognize the exceptional nature of the curfew. But it's also we're living in exceptional times, and I think that if we have daily missile attacks on the heart of the state of Israel, we have a right to defend ourselves, and including against the Palestinian population who have expressed their joy and glee for every missile that falls on the state.
The Israeli government gave gas masks to all Israeli citizens, but the Palestinians in the occupied territories were not given gas masks. What was the reason for that policy, and were they able to purchase gas masks?
The territories have never, ever been a target for any military or terrorist attack. So over the years, they've never been discerned, and they've never seen themselves as a target of any other Arab country. So there was never any civil defense apparatus established in the territories. Only recently have we seen some type of possibility that they would be hurt by any type of conflict. So we never planned to distribute gas masks because we never saw them as a potential target. Only recently has that problem arisen. And what we've done is we've gone and purchased about 180,000 gas masks. We're manufacturing more. And we've begun a distribution of those gas masks along the Green Line, along the 1967 border with Israel, to make sure that, first of all, those Arabs living, those Palestinian Arabs living along the Green Line will have gas masks. And if a missile does, by mistake, fall in their vicinity, at least that they will be protected. In addition, we hope to broaden the distribution to include the general population of the territories. But at the same time, we won't be able to do the same thing within a period of months that we've done over a period of more than 20 years in which we've accumulated gas masks and built a civil defense apparatus for the people of Israel. So we don't think that the situation is comparable. We still don't think they're a target, but we recognize our need and our responsibility to defend them in case, by some mistake, a missile lands in their area.
Were Palestinians allowed to purchase gas masks?
Palestinians are allowed to purchase gas masks, but we're not, at this point, even requesting that they purchase it. We're distributing the 180,000 gas masks at no cost. If they want to privately purchase gas masks, that's their business.
Moshe Fogel is a press spokesperson for the Israeli Defense Force. He spoke to us earlier today from Jerusalem. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.